This week on Making Contact.
All that Occupy is doing is correcting a sad 50-year history by forcing us finally to put our economic system where it should have been, as an object to be criticized and debated.
Occupy Wall Street has changed the conversation about the distribution of wealth and an economic framework which for decades has been taken for granted. So what now?
What we need, and what I would hope Occupy demands, is a federal employment program, but radically different from what was in the 1930s.
On this edition, economics professor Richard Wolff on some of the roots of and solutions to the economic inequality that's finally being acknowledged. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Well, I think that the Occupy movement has been nothing short of genius in how it's developed. If you're going to make change, you have to get people who disagree on all kinds of things to trust each other and to work together. That's the hardest thing, because that's the way the left in the past has been splintered in this country. And to do what they did, to come up with a set of very general slogans like 1% versus 99%, or being angry at the businesses, or questioning capitalism, or the basic themes that they developed, was exactly the right thing. It is a big tent. It allows all kinds of people to get together, to work together, to get to know each other, to understand their differences, not be threatened by them, see the differences as a very important glue that can hold them together. So I think this is a movement that has stunningly understood and incorporated fundamental political lessons about gathering people together.
That's Professor Richard Wolff. He taught economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst for 35 years and is currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York City. Wolff's been observing and participating in the Occupy movement.
The second thing that Occupy does that's a game changer and brilliant was its courage and determination against all kinds of advice, not just the kind I would have given them, to put the question of economic inequality, of the economic system, of capitalism, right out front, right at the beginning, no holds barred. We're the 99%. Our adversary is the 1%. They control the economy. They've bought the political system. They're the problem. We're going to have to change all that. That has been something the vast majority of left-leaning movements in America have been terrified of for half a century. Whether you call that the legacy of the Cold War, or whether you call that the legacy of the anti-communism of the early parts of the Cold War, whatever you call it, it has immobilized and undermined left movements in this country for half a century. And they dealt with that by not beating around the bush, not hiding, not prevaricating, but putting it right out front. And instead of that being a problem of frightening people away, it had exactly the opposite effect.
New York, I say Occupy, you say Boston, Occupy, Boston, Occupy, Boston.
Thousands camped out across the country last fall. Tens of thousands participated in marches, rallies, and general assemblies. And despite the mainstream media's shift of focus to the 2012 elections, Occupy is still in the streets.
Occupy Houston! I say Occupy, you say Miami! Occupy Miami!
On January 20th, a national Occupy Day of Action, protesters in San Francisco organized Occupy Wall Street West, focusing on the offices of major banks, investment firms, and government buildings. Making Contact found housing attorney Deepa Varna as her affinity group was being threatened with arrest for chaining themselves together and blockading the doors to Bank of America's corporate offices.
I just want to ask you to leave without us having to arrest you. You do have my support, but here's the issue. This is property that you're blocking. And this is, you're making it so that people can conduct business. So if you want to continue that, they're going to sign a private person's arrest, we're going to have to arrest you. I'd rather not arrest you. I'd rather you just leave. So those are the two options. You either leave or you're going to get it, end up being arrested. Okay? Can we just leave? You've been here long enough. Come on now. You've been here since 8 o'clock this morning. You've made your point. You haven't been arrested at this point.
I'm not sure if we've made our point yet. We're talking about a really broad systemic change we're looking for, and we're probably going to have to keep doing this for as long as these banks exist, possibly. Bank of America has been one of the worst offenders in terms of the foreclosure crisis, in terms of the mortgage crisis. Until more of the general population sort of realizes that we're all part of the same team here and that we're all being affected by this economic system, by this unsustainable system economically and environmentally, and led by these companies, I think we're going to have to stay.
So people on the radio may not see that there actually is an arrest warrant on the Bank of America building here. You want to read that out?
Arrest warrant to any sheriff or constable of the city and county of San Francisco. You are hereby commanded to arrest Bank of America to face the following charges: for foreclosing on families, for bankrolling climate change, for destroying communities through underwriting coal fire power plants, particularly in the Appalachians, for paying millions in executive bonuses while laying off thousands of workers, and be brought before a judge or judicial officer representing the city and county of San Francisco immediately by order of the 99%.
Occupy for jobs!
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 We have had between 9 and 10% basically unemployment. And if you actually do the proper numbers, you use what's called the U6 number that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses. We're talking 15 to 16% of unemployment in the United States, people who have no job, people who have given up looking, and people who have part-time jobs but involuntarily because they want a full-time job. You're talking 1 out of 6 Americans. That's a disaster for our economy. It's also the case that these people are unemployed for longer periods of time than we have any record of in the history of this country. And the longer a person is unemployed, the more devastating the effects. You use up your savings, you become a burden on your friends and family and relatives and neighbors, you lose your skills, you lose your contacts. So the costs, the social costs of unemployment, which are enormous anyway, are even worse when they last a long time. And this unemployment has been in the 8.5, 9, 10% range for 3 years now. Nothing has been done. The Bush program, when he was president, was to stimulate and incentivize the private sector to hire people. Obama has said exactly the same thing. He said it as a campaigner. He said it as president. And the fact that for the last 3 years, the unemployment has remained at the same level, despite incentives and despite subsidies given to the private sector, would have led any person not in the pocket of big business to have realized that that program doesn't work and that another one would be necessary. But because both parties are in the pockets of the business community, who has no interest in solving this problem, no interest in solving it at its expense, or to allow any infringement on their freedoms, we don't have an adequate solution. The last time we had unemployment this bad, lasting this long, the 1930s, the president went on the radio, Roosevelt, and he said, if the private sector cannot or will not hire the people, then the federal government is going to do it. Between 1934 and 41, Roosevelt created and filled 12 million jobs. Today's population in the United States would be double that. And therefore, that would be a major solution to the unemployment problem. It's not a solution that comes from Russia or China or Cuba or any of the bugaboo places that people would like to dismiss. It's our own history that the current crop of Republican and Democratic leaders chooses to forget, never bring up, never provide therefore the faintest excuse why not to do today what was the necessary thing to do the last time we had a crisis of this sort. So the first thing Occupy ought to do is demand that. But that's only the first. The second thing is to learn from the mistakes that were made. The reason Roosevelt had to provide public jobs was because he had a mass movement there. He had what Occupy is now trying to build. A powerful CIO that organized more workers in the 1930s than any union wave in America had ever organized before or ever organized since. Millions of people joined unions. You had a powerful set of socialist parties with large memberships and a powerful communist party with large membership and lots of overlap between the socialist party and the unions and the communist party and the unions so that they could work together, a dense network of people. And they forced that Roosevelt to change. But notwithstanding that, they made a colossal mistake. And Occupy has to learn. This is the most crucial thing to get across. They have to learn from the mistake. What was the mistake? You imposed on the business community and on the rich regulations and taxes. Regulations to try to prevent another great crisis, and taxes to pay for hiring those millions of people. Someone had to pay for those workers to build the national parks and build the highways and build, if I'm not mistaken, the Golden Gate Bridge, among other things. So when you did that, when you went after the wealthy and the businesses to tax them, to pay for this solution, and to regulate the system, you made their boards of directors and their shareholders the enemy of all of this because you were hurting their profits. You were taxing their wealth. You were regulating their ability to make money. And so what they did, as soon as they were able, which was usually before the ink was dry on the bills that raised the taxes and imposed the regulations, they went to work to undo the New Deal that had been imposed on them. And the mistake of the movements then was to leave them in a position to do it, to let them gather into their hands the profits of our society, the wealth we create year in and year out, the difference between the value of what we all as workers produce and what we get as wages and salary. That profit they used to undo the regulations, to reduce the taxes. The great reform movements of the 1930s never touched the capacity of the business community to hold on to the wealth and to use it to undo the New Deal. So what Occupy has to learn now, one lesson, reproduce the movements of the 30s that won the reforms. Second lesson, don't stop at reform, because if you do, you will simply set in motion the undoing of whatever it is we achieve this time, just as the movements of the 30s set in motion the conditions that make us now have taxes one-third of what they were in the 1940s, regulations that have completely disappeared. For example, the Banking Act, the Glass-Steagall Act, imposed on banks in the 30s, was undone by the late 1990s, signed by President Clinton in 1999. 8 years later, the banking system collapses again. It's like a joke. And so Occupy has to take the bite, take the courage. You cannot leave in place the classic capitalist enterprise controlled by the major shareholders and the boards of directors, because they will do what they have done. Take the money they keep drawing into their hands, use the wealth of this society to undo every reform, every tax imposed on them, until we're back again in an economic system making a lot of money for them and crisis for everybody else.
We'll be right back with more from economics professor Rick Wolf after a break. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. As we heard in the first half of the show, Rick Wolf is inspired by the movements of the 1930s that forced President Roosevelt to create regulations and raise taxes. But Wolf warns that in the past, these reforms have been rolled back because the classic capitalist enterprise remained unchanged. Making Contact's executive director, Lisa Rudman, sat down with Rick Wolf to get his ideas about what could be done differently this time around.
If the idea is to have taxation, regulation, and to somehow prevent them from rolling those things back, what's the recipe for preventing this rollback? What are the elements of that?
Okay, here's how we would do it. First, we have to face what we're saying, and I want to be clear, no shying away, no drawing back. We're going to change. We need to change the organization of production, the way enterprises are organized. No more you and I come to work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and then we go home at the end of the day or the week, and we leave behind everything we produced. What we poured our mental and physical capabilities into producing belongs instantaneously to someone else. That's got to stop. It's got to be the mass of people who dispose of the wealth they create so it cannot be used to create a 1%, 99% dichotomy, cannot be used to undo the reforms we worked so hard to put into place to protect ourselves. So it's very clear we have to change the organization of production.
But Rick, people would say, oh my God, you're pie in the sky. You're talking about collective workplaces. You're talking about total transformation. Help people to bridge where we are now and this wonderful, it's an attractive vision. How do you get there?
Here's the way you institutionalize it. We now have, depending on how you count, 20 to 25 million people without work or without the kind of work that they want. That's one-fifth of our total labor force in this country. So we're talking about a major chunk. What we need and what I would hope Occupy demands is a federal employment program, but radically different from what was in the 1930s. Here's the demand. The government will provide the capital and the technical assistance for these 25 million people to go back to work in enterprises that they themselves control. And let me give you an example of how practical this is. And the best way I know how to do that is to give you the name of a law in a country which already does it. In Italy, right now, there's a law. I believe it's called the Marcona Law, but it may be a slightly different name, named after the legislator who pushed it through. It's been on the books in Italy for at least 20 years. And here's what it does. If you are unemployed in Italy, you have a choice. You can either get on the dole the way we do here in this country. You get so much money per week, depending on the job you had before, for so and many weeks to see you through the unemployment time. Or, in Italy, you get a choice. The government will give you 3 years' worth of your weekly unemployment payments up front in a lump on the following condition. You must get, I believe it's at least eight other workers, eight or more, to make the same, unemployed, make the same choice you do. Each of them will get the upfront money on condition that you begin and operate a collective enterprise on your own. And the stick, if you like, together with the carrot, is this. If the enterprise goes belly up, you don't get any unemployment. This is your unemployment. So you're going to see a dozen workers, two dozen, 100, 200, getting together, working as hard as they can, because this is their own future. This is their long-term and short-term. This is their solution. And it has worked very well in Italy. And I think here in the United States it would work, because here's what would happen. We would have, for the first time in America, a real choice for workers between a top-down, old-style capitalist enterprise and these millions of people forming the other kind of enterprise with government support and government money up front as an alternative to the old unemployment system. We would allow people to be able to go into a store and buy a product that had on its label not just the country from which it came, and maybe not even just the fair trade it might have come through. But for the first time, the labels will be required to say, this business was made in a capitalist enterprise. This business was made in an enterprise where the workers are their own bosses. And I got a news for you. Every poll of the American people taken in the last 50 years says that the American people would love to be able to buy goods that were produced by workers who were their own bosses, since the overwhelming majority of American workers want to be their own bosses.
Since you're saying polls show that people want to be their own bosses, what are the other mental shifts that people need to do around their understanding of these systems and class consciousness? How do you see that fitting in?
If workers ran their own enterprises, here's what they would never do. They would never give managers, even the top managers in their enterprise, on average, 350 times the average wage of the worker. That would never happen if workers made these decisions collectively. And that's the single most important decision that shapes the gap between the 99% and the 1%. So if you're concerned about inequality of income in this country, as the polls show the majority of Americans are, then here is a concrete way to finally do something about it. By changing the organization of the enterprise, you put the decision makers as the mass of people, and they would never articulate, they would never support, they would never continue a level of inequality, anything like what we have in the United States today. We even have examples in places like Mondragon in Spain, where there are workers who make these decisions. The average rate is between 8 and 10 times is the gap between the highest paid worker at the top of a hierarchy and everybody else. But there's more. If workers made the decisions collectively, they wouldn't move the factories to China. I hate to be blunt about this, but the whole exodus of enterprise out of the United States would come to a massive grinding halt. Now, that would incur all kinds of costs and problems. Of course it would. Just like what we do now, which would allow them to leave, costs us massively as a society. And we would have to work on that. But if that's a concern, the loss of jobs and the loss, therefore, of the bargaining power of working people because there aren't the jobs and therefore there's not the need for them, then one way to handle this is to stop the movement of jobs, because workers are not going to eradicate their own employment. And finally, another example. An awful lot of people are concerned about the destruction of the environment, whether it's the air, the water, etc. Well, we have a situation in which the single most important pollution in our society has to do with how we organize production. Whether it's what comes out of the smokestack of a factory, whether it's what comes out of what cleanser is used to keep the toilets clean, whatever it is. Well, the problem is, in most cases, that the decision what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, is made by a board of directors, 10 or 15 people, selected by major shareholders, another 10 or 15 people, who sit often thousands of miles away and who make the decision what you're going to use in your enterprise. All that's gone if the workers themselves are making these decisions, because they and their husbands and their wives and their children and their neighbors are going to have to breathe what goes on in that factory, live with the consequences. If you want to make a major move in the direction of a green United States, a greening of our disastrous interaction with nature, then put the people who have to live with the consequences in the decision-making position. I mean, democracy calls for no less anyway, but here are three practical ways: drastically reduce the inequality of income and therefore wealth, drastically stop the destruction of our unions and our working people by the exodus of jobs, and drastically reorganize the production process in the interest of a better relationship with nature. All of those could be given quantum steps forward by this change.
What's in it for the 1%? You've talked about the dreams, the aspirations, the possible new structures that the 99% could promote. What's in it for the 1%?
The job of Occupy is to split the 1%, to appeal to those within that who understand in the long run that this is what's best for the people of this world, of whom they are a part. You know, in the 1930s, when the CIO, the socialists, and the communists put all that pressure on Roosevelt that I spoke about earlier, Roosevelt used that pressure to go to the rich and to the corporations from whom he came, given who he was and his family. And he said to them, you better give me the money to provide the jobs for the unemployed, to create the Social Security system, which he did, to create the unemployment insurance system of America, which he did. You better give me the money to do it, because if you don't, it won't be me that you're dealing with. It will be those union people and those socialists and communists, and they're going to make a lot worse deal for you than I will. He split them. That's the only way the New Deal got passed. He split the business community. Half of them went with him and bought his argument. The other half were implacable enemies of his and went to work to undo the New Deal. And those are the Republicans then, and those are the Republicans today, who undo everything as fast as they can because they're serving the angry part of the business community that were never won over. But the point is, Roosevelt split them. We can split them again. We have to split them and say, look, come across and make a deal with us as far as you can, because it's in the interest of equity, it's in the interest of democracy, it's in the interest of the long-term viability of the United States, it's in the interest of avoiding civil conflict on a scale that is scary to contemplate, and for all those reasons, here's a deal we can work out and live with. I don't know how successful that'll be. It worked for Roosevelt, which is enough of a reason for it to be tried again. But it may not work, and then we'll have to struggle the 99 against a 1%. But even that is a kind of an open question. No one thought in the years before the collapse of the Soviet Union that it would collapse. No one thought that Mr. Mubarak in Egypt would be hounded out of office. No one thought, I'll finish the point. No one thinks it could happen in the United States. It's the same mistake. You build up the contradictions of a system long enough, and they blow up in your face. For 50 years, for the last half century in the United States, we have debated as a nation our transportation system, our education system, our health system. All the basic institutions of this society have been criticized and debated and changed, as should happen in a healthy society. One institution could not be criticized, could not be subject to national debate, could not be changed. That's called capitalism. It's our economic system, and it was taboo in this country. And you know, if you have an institution central to your society that cannot be criticized, cannot be debated, where all politicians struggle with one another to be the bigger cheerleader for the system, what you have is a system that behind that wall of protection rots, breaks down, becomes dysfunctional because it's never had its warts and its blemishes identified. There's been no change. All that Occupy is doing is correcting a sad 50-year history by forcing us finally to put our economic system where it should have been, upfront, personal, as an object to be criticized and debated. And if, as some of us believe, and I'm one of them, that this is a system whose historical justification is now over, then it's time to move on. The United States can do better than capitalism.
You've been listening to economics professor Richard Wolff speaking with Making Contact's Lisa Rudman. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Go to our website to hear outtakes of that interview, including Richard Wolff on the European Union's renewed racism and fascism. Our website is radioproject.org. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Kyunjin Lee and Esther Mania producers, Irene Flores, web editor, Steph St. Clair, development associate, Lisa Bartfai and Christopher Holmbach, production interns, Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, Megan LaSala, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, and Rachel Kozlowski, volunteers. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.